all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit provides information on how you can lead a healthy lifestyle. I'm the host, Josie Bidwell. Search for and subscribe to Southern Remedy on any podcasting app to not miss any episode.
This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. Today, we are going to be talking about GI complaints. We get these a lot in clinic, starts in our little infants, and all the way through our adults. GI complaints are extremely common, and so today we're going to talk about those. We're going to talk about some of the common reasons we have people complaining about their GI system, and when should you be concerned, when do you need to have a scope, and we'll talk about just some home remedies and different things that we do to help treat those issues. We would love to hear from you. You can always send us an email to kids@mpbonline.org. So I feel like this is kind of a very generic topic when I say GI stuff. So I'm just going to talk about some of the common things that we get questions about in clinic. So I'll just start real quick by talking about abdominal pain, because I feel like we see that all the time in our kids. And kids are tricky because you kind of have to be careful, because my stomach hurts is like one of the most common complaints kids will say when they don't want to do something. You know, they'll say, my head hurts, my stomach hurts. And they know that their stomach hurts can get them out of a lot of different things. So I will preface it with that, because it can be really hard to say, okay, are they truly, you know, something really going wrong, or are they just trying to get out of what they have to do? So first thing I would say for that, because parents ask us this question a lot, first thing I would say is look at the situation. You know, is it happening right before they go to school? Is it happening right before bedtime? You know, do you know that there is some kind of experience, or maybe there's like a test at school, or there's cheerleader tryouts, or something happening that's coming up within the near future, and they're talking about abdominal pain. So, you know, you very situational can make a big difference. So that would say, first and foremost, look at the situation. The other thing I always like to tell parents is, does it affect their everyday activities? Because kids, if they're, you know, it takes a lot, especially our younger kids, when they're outside playing or playing on their video games or whatever it may be, it's going to take a lot to get them distracted and to come inside or to turn off their video games. You know, just a little stomach ache's probably not going to do that. So if they're saying that their stomach hurts enough that it's actually making them stop their activity, that's always a concern too. So those are two of the biggest things I would say. If your kid complains of abdominal pain a lot, like, let's look at the situation. What is the timing of the complaints? And then two, is it actually affecting their everyday activity? Is it preventing them from doing the things that they actually enjoy? And then if it is, that's definitely concerning. And you want to get them in the clinic so we can figure out what's going on. For our younger kids, it's a lot harder because, my goodness, the list is like ridiculously long about what it could be. Some of the things that I would say would be concerning and when you need to get checked out for abdominal pain would be if you were having associated fever. So a lot of times fever and abdominal pain usually mean something's going on. Now, sometimes kids just complain of abdominal pain when they have a fever just because they don't know what else to say. I mean, you know, when you have a fever, your whole body just like feels yuck. And so, you know, as a kid, it's hard for even an adult to like say how you feel when you have a fever. You just feel yuck, you know? So it's hard for a little kid to say that. So they may complain of their abdomen hurting just with that. But for the most part, if you have a fever and abdominal pain, we get a little concerned. There could be some different things going on. And this is for adults as well. It could be something as simple as strep throat. because, you know, strep throat, which sounds crazy, but strep throat, when you have a strep infection, it can actually cause some swelling and inflammation of the lymph nodes in your abdomen. They can actually look and feel a lot like appendicitis, because it can be pretty painful, actually. So fever and abdominal pain, it can be something as simple as strep throat, but it can be something as serious as, you know, a kidney infection, or an appendicitis or gallbladder infection. You know, I mean, there's a whole list of things to think about. So just some quick and dirty things that we think about in the clinic. If you're pretty healthy looking, but you're having fever and abdominal pain, a urine test. So we always want to ask your child, too, if they're complaining about that, or if they're not old enough to be able to tell you, smell their diaper, if their urine smells. But UTI is very common for that. If it was the appendix, if it was the gallbladder, they're going to be pretty exquisitely tender. And so they're not going to want you to touch the appendix is the right lower side. The gallbladder is the right upper side. So anything on that right side is something that we worry about. If you're having fever, too, in an adult, obviously, we think about the appendix and the kidney infections and the bladder infections, gallbladder. But another thing to kind of throw in there is diverticulitis. I don't know if people are familiar with that. But diverticulitis is, so you can have what we call diverticulosis when you have little outpatchings of your colon. Very common as people get older. We see that a lot. Most of the time, it doesn't cause any problem. But in some of our patients, it can get inflamed and infected. And typically in adults, that's going to be on the left side of the belly. So just some things to think about. A lot, and the reason I'm bringing that up is because pretty everything that I just listed needs antibiotics. And that's something that you would need to be treated for. So all that being said is, if you have fever and abdominal pain, go get checked out, because we need to make sure there's nothing serious going on that you would need antibiotics and or surgery for. So fever is definitely a concerning symptom with the abdominal pain. Another thing would be weight loss. So if you've noticed that your kid is complaining of abdominal pain over, you know, a month or so, or maybe you have been having some abdominal pain as well, this is for adults too, and then you notice that you've lost weight, or your kid's lost weight, or, you know, your spouse has been complaining about abdominal pain and you notice that, hey, his clothes aren't fitting as well as they used to. You know, that's all concerning symptoms, weight loss associated with the abdominal pain, especially if the weight loss is unintentional. So you want to make sure that you get that checked out, because we need to figure out what could be going on. Another one would be like persistent vomiting or persistent diarrhea associated with it. Now, you can have some abdominal pain and then have, you know, a day or two here or there of vomiting or diarrhea. But if this is something that is associated with the abdominal pain and it is persisting, then that's something that you want to make sure that you're getting checked out. If you're having blood in your stool and associated with the abdominal pain, even your child too, because we can have, you know, in adults, we think about, in older kids, we think about inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. In adults, we worry about cancer. But in our kids, they can also get blood in their stool if they have a really bad milk allergy too. So if you think your child is having abdominal pain and you notice that, you want to make sure you get that checked out as well, because it could be something you just need to actually to change their diet up a little bit.
I've heard that lactose intolerance is way more common than we think.
Yes.
Like, so, almost everybody has at least some intolerance to lactose. Is that true?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I wouldn't say everybody, but I mean, at some point, yeah, probably. And you can get transient lactose intolerances as well. So, and let me just preface it with, there's a difference between like a milk protein allergy versus intolerance, because there's a lot of people who are intolerant, like you said, which just means you're a little more gassy if you eat things with milk. You know, if you eat a lot of cheese or dairy, you may notice that you're a little more bloated, gassy. Some people even have diarrhea. But a true allergy is like your body is having a reaction, a true reaction to it. And so you will have problems with blood in your stool or weight loss or persistent vomiting, those types of symptoms. So there is a difference between allergy versus intolerance. So that's something to remember. And that that being said, just to kind of piggyback off of that, I think we've talked about this before, but when you think of like food allergies, and there's a big difference between allergies and intolerances. So there's a lot of people who get these like food tests done, and they'll get a list of like all the things that they could potentially be allergic to. And it can list all kinds of things, but you've been able to eat those things your whole life and have never had a problem with it. So there, a lot of the allergists and the GI doctors are kind of against a lot of those tests because you will be labeled as intolerant to a lot of things that you've been able to eat your whole life.
Like gluten. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, gluten, but like I have people that come in and have like done those tests and they're like, well, I've cut out eggs, I've cut out dairy, I've cut out gluten, I've cut out this. And I'm like, what are you eating?
Right. Lettuce. Know? You're eating lettuce and strawberries.
Yeah. And I mean, in certain situations, that is something that you need to do. Elimination diets in certain people is a thing that we need to do. But for majority of people, you don't have to eliminate everything just because the test said that you could potentially have an intolerance to it. Because it's a very high likelihood that if you ran that test on me and you, we would have several things listed on there that we've eaten our whole lives and never had a problem with.
We're used to it.
Yeah. So that's the thing about the intolerance. And what I was going to piggyback off of when I said you can get like a temporary one too. So a lot of times we'll see people after they have a really bad stomach virus. And I don't know, you know, if you've been out there, I think for like everybody at some point has stomach virus. You vomit for about a day or two. You know, usually the vomiting lasts about 24 to 36 hours, not much more than that. And then the diarrhea sets in for most people. And then the diarrhea usually lasts a day or two. But sometimes, and I'm sure everybody out there has had this happen before, it feels like it doesn't go away. The diarrhea part just kind of lingers for days. And so like the vomiting went away really quickly, but the diarrhea has persisted. And sometimes if you have a bad enough infection and virus, it can actually damage the lining of the colon. So the little villi that get out there and help absorb some of that water, it damages that. And so instead of absorbing the water, you continue to just have really loose stools. And a lot of that has to do with the lactose. So if you go off of dairy products for a few days, it usually makes a big difference. And our kids, sometimes we'll have to switch them to like a soy milk for a few days. And that can make a big difference with just kind of letting that villi and the colon lining heal up a little bit. And then this, like the diarrhea goes away. It's really weird. So.
Yeah. Agreed. This conversation's making my stomach hurt.
But yeah, it is pretty common for that to happen, to have those little transient ones after GI infection. So just something to keep in the back of your mind. If, you know, you had a little stomach bug and you feel like the diarrhea is lingering, try cutting out dairy, limiting your milk, your cheeses, yogurts, things like that. And I bet it will get better after a little bit. So,
yeah. Well, my early collegiate years, I had to go to the ER for some colitis pain, mm-hmm. and I got a list a mile long of foods not to eat for like 2 weeks. It was a lot of spicy foods, mm-hmm. and it was a lot of high acidity stuff, mm-hmm. and it was a temporary, you know, restriction, mm-hmm. but they said maybe keep your eye on how much of this you intake throughout your life since you have these issues.
Right. And yeah, like I was saying, there are certain situations where you have to look at an elimination diet and figure that out, because it could be that there are certain foods that are triggering you. The biggest concern with our GI doctors and the allergy doctors is if you eliminate everything and you actually potentially could tolerate those things, it could eventually affect your nutrition. You know, if you're cutting everything out, you may at some point become vitamin deficient in certain things, or your bones health may be affected because of the minerals and things that you've cut out. So it's just, you know, in certain situations, eliminating things can be important, especially if you're having chronic GI issues and you're trying to get to the bottom of it. But for majority of people, it is not recommended to just cut everything out just because somebody says that you're intolerant to it. You need to, you know, if you've always tolerated it and have been fine. So we are going to talk about reflux, because I feel like that is one of the bigger topics. And, you know, Lacey, you were talking about spicy foods, acidic foods. Those are some of the big things that come up when we talk about reflux. So if you have any questions or comments, you can always send us an email to kids@mpbonline.org. This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. We are talking today about GI concerns, but we are here to answer any questions that you may have. Send us an email to kids@mpbonline.org. So we have a caller, Robin, on the phone. Hey, good morning, yeah. Robin. What's going on?
Hey, when I sit down or lay down, I'm pinching a nerve in two fingers, the middle finger and the fourth finger on my left hand, go completely numb. Once I stand up, it immediately, in a few seconds, stops. Hmm. Sometimes I can adjust the way I'm sitting and it'll stop. But my question is this something I can look at maybe through a chiropractor, or do I need to go to a doctor?
I would go with a doctor because you said it's the middle and fourth finger?
Yes, they go completely numb.
Okay.
And tingle. And
yeah, so that's, one of the big things we think about in the hands when that happens is like carpal tunnel, but that's the wrong distribution for that. I would think more of you've got a trapped nerve somewhere, probably from your neck. I don't know if you have neck pain or if you've ever had.
Not at all.
No. And it could
it's
be.
Only, and it's only when, I, it only happens when I sit down.
And like, and does that mean like your arms hanging?
Yeah, well, my arm could be in my lap or right now I'm pulled over to the side of the road, but it's sort of tingling while I'm driving with my hand on the steering wheel.
Yeah, that's really strange. We think about the nerves. So the nerves that innervate your arm and your hand come from your neck. And so at some point, I would think as that nerve is coming out of your neck, it's getting trapped somewhere. You can have that sometimes happen with like your shoulder or your elbow too, especially if you have some inflammation there. But again, that would be more, you would think you would be having some pain in your shoulder and elbow too because of the inflammation. So to me, I would think I would be concerned about your neck first. So I would go see a doctor, let them take some x-rays and see if you have some degenerative changes there or any evidence of like a slip disc there. I have had people who did not necessarily have neck pain, but have had the nerve symptoms, and it was all related to some changes in their neck. And if that's the case, a lot of times PT, physical therapy, can actually be really helpful for that. Not knocking a chiropractor necessarily, but that's typically where I start, is getting some films of the neck. And then I would refer you to some physical therapy because there's a lot of good things that the physical therapist can do to help relieve some of that.
Okay. That's just odd that it's only when I sit down or when I go to bed at night, if I lay wrong, mm-hmm. just those two fingers go numb.
Yeah.
But the minute I stand up, blood seems to be flowing or whatever it is, and it goes away.
Yeah. Yeah, the positioning of it, that's a very odd story. But I still think I would start with the neck, looking into that and some physical therapy. Now, there are some other blood tests that to do, like thyroid, checking for your diabetes, checking for a B12 deficiency. These are all things that can cause nerve problems too. But typically, you're going to have that in more than one spot than just those two fingers. But it's probably worthwhile for your doctor to get that lab work checked too, just to make sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for your call. All right, we've got another call. I think it says Eldon.
Yes.
Hey, what's going on this morning?
Well, I heard you were fixing to talk about reflux and heartburn, and I was just kind of curious, are there any markers to differentiate between true heartburn and maybe a heart attack? Because, I know they give a lot of times that had been diagnoses that were missed, and if you didn't feel comfortable with the diagnosis of the heartburn from a doctor, is there any other thing that you would need to do to rule out possible heart attack?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Because if you've had really bad heartburn, you know how painful it can be. And it mm-hmm. hurts right there in the center of your chest for a lot of people. And so it can be pretty painful and concerning for your heart. So first, I would say try to take an acid neutralizer medicine. So you could get you some Tums, some Rolaids, you know, whatever your antacid of choice would be, and see, because those medicines work really quickly. And so if you can take those medicines and they're not helping it at all, then I would say that would be something concerning, because if it's persistent pain in your chest and they're not relieved by antacids, then that's concerning. The other thing I would think about is, are you having any other symptoms? Are you having any dizziness? Is the pain moving anywhere else? Because a lot of times, if it is truly your heart, it will have some radiation like to your neck or down your arm. And so you want to see if anything else is happening. And then lastly, I would say, look at your situation. You know, if you're just sitting on, you just ate a big supper and you're sitting on the couch watching TV, it's probably heartburn. But you know, if you're out and about and you've been, you know, busy for the day and walking around a lot and all of that kind of stuff, where you've actually put some stress on your heart and now you're having some of these symptoms, that would also be really concerning. But I would say first and foremost, just start with some antacids, as long as you're not having any other symptoms. And then if it doesn't get better, then you want to seek treatment and see what's going on. But it definitely, right. If there's ever a concern or question about it, and you have, especially if you have risk factors for heart problems like high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, or you've had a heart attack before, then you need to err on the side of, okay, this could be my heart. Let me get checked out.
Absolutely. That makes sense, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your call. All right, if you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-877-MPB-RING, 1-877-672-7464. So let's focus on reflux, since our first caller kind of started off that conversation. So reflux, heartburn, it's when the stomach, the gastric contents or the contents that are in the stomach, reflux up into the esophagus. So, you know, the esophagus is the tube that we use to swallow, and the food goes down our esophagus in our throat and it ends in the stomach. The way that most people eat, we eat heavier, especially like at supper time. We usually eat our heaviest meal at supper time, our biggest meal at supper time. And then we go lay down and we go to bed. Well, if we lay down, we haven't let a lot of those contents pass on through. And so some of it's going to come back up. When you think about little babies, here we are giving them either breast milk or formula, and we're given we always say that the baby's stomach is about the size of their fist. So if you look at a baby's fist and then you look at a bottle that has 4 ounces in it, and you're like, well, hey, that's not all going to fit in there. And so it's the same thing. You know, some of it is going to come back up. So we are all prone to reflux. I mean, it's just kind of the nature of the way we are, the nature of our lifestyle, that we all are prone to be able to have some reflux. However, it doesn't affect everybody the same. I never had problems with reflux until I was pregnant. And for the most part, mine went away after pregnancy. So, you know, but there are lots of people out there that suffer with reflux, and it all is very situational. Some people's are worse with certain foods. Some people's are worse all the time. And then in some people, which we're going to talk about, there's some underlying problems that lead them to more reflux. So, and more worsening of symptoms with reflux.
What's the youngest you can get diagnosed with that, Doc?
Oh, like little bitty babies. Yeah. Actually, my little girl, she was... Oh, we ended up having to take her to the ER because I thought she had potentially, hers got so bad at one point that she was losing weight. She was 3 months old at the time. She had dropped. She had lost weight. She was vomiting profusely, so much so that I was worried she had a condition called pyloric stenosis because, I mean, I could not. I mean, it was terrible. It was so bad. So we went to the ER to get an ultrasound to make sure. And sure enough, she was fine. It was just terrible, terrible reflux. So yeah, little bitty babies. It starts as early as like 2 to 3 weeks, peaks somewhere around 4 to 6 months, which is why mine babies got so bad. She was about 3.5 months, almost 4 months old when hers got terrible. And so it does tend to peak around 4 to 6 months. And then it can get, it usually gets better as they get bigger. But yeah, no, little bitty babies, it can happen too.
Sounds like baby Lacey.
Yeah, did you have it too?
I have it to this day.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I mean, I keep Omniprozol and business.
Yeah. 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 Well, so we'll talk about that with the fact if your symptoms are so bad, because we try to keep people off Omeprazole and medicines like that long term if we can. Now, there's some people that are just like, nah, I got to have it. But there are some potential side effects of those medications. And so that's why we try to get people off of it. So we'll talk about when it's concerning and when you need to get scoped and all of that kind of stuff, because I want to make sure we bring that up, because it is important if it's not getting better and you're having to stay on your medicine. So, but yeah, little babies, and the little babies are the worst setup for reflux, to be honest. But thankfully, babies are a lot tougher than us as adults, and they're a lot more resilient than us as adults. And so for the most part, they're fine. They spit up, they smile, they keep them going. They don't really have many problems with it. When it becomes a concern with little babies is like my little girl, when she quit growing, you know, she was at like the 60th, 70th percentile and dropped all the way down to the 10th percentile because she got, you know, she couldn't keep anything down. Or if they're extremely fussy. So there are some babies that it actually is very upsetting to them and very uncomfortable to them. And those are the babies we worry about too, because, you know, we don't want our babies to be hurting. But I would say, I mean, probably 80-something percent of babies are what we deem happy spitters. They just spit up and they just keep on going. And they're just constantly spitting up and it doesn't seem to bother them. They're
what
still
a
happy.
Life.
I know, right?
What a life.
And so majority of our babies are happy spitters. But some of the things to do if your baby is bad at spitting up is slowing them down with their bottles. Now, if they're breastfed, it's a little bit trickier because we don't really like you taking them off the breast, because that can, you know, interrupt some latching and things like that. But if they're bottle fed, you can try to pause them at more regular intervals. So if they're taking a 4-ounce bottle, you know, pause them about every 1 to 1.5 ounces, make them burp, just lets that milk have a little time to pass on through, trying to keep them upright, because that's another thing that's bad for the babies. Like I mentioned, as adults, a lot of times we eat our biggest meal at dinner, then we go lay down for bed not long after that. Well, of course, it's going to come up. Well, our poor little babies, they can't sit up. They're not up and walking. And so if they lay down, that just makes it worse. So trying to keep them upright, trying to pause them as they eat. And then the biggest thing that we see is overfeeding, giving them too much in their bottle. So, you know, that would be something to talk to your pediatrician about, is my baby getting too much? How much should they be getting? And they can help you come up with a plan to help with that overfeeding. With our older kids and adults, it's pretty much what we do to ourselves. It's mostly food related, and it's what we are doing and what we're taking in that's causing our reflux. Again, there can be some other conditions, and I want to make sure we talk about that, but we will talk more about what type of foods make it worse, some of the conditions that I was mentioning, when do you need to go get a scope to see what's going on, and then what you can do about it. This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. We are talking today about GI complaints. And before the break, we talked a lot about when you should be concerned about abdominal pain, what are some of the concerning symptoms, when should you go to the doctor. Then we kind of introduced reflux a little bit, because that seems to be one of the bigger complaints that we see. And we talked about babies, and now I'm going to talk about bigger kids and adults, and what you can do for the reflux symptoms for them. And then I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about some of the medicines, because we have a lot of questions about medicines in clinic, about what can we take for the reflux. So I talked earlier about babies and how they're just unfortunately a setup for it, as opposed to bigger kids and adults. Unfortunately, it's a lot of the things that we do to ourselves. Not always. You know, there's some people who have anatomical things that do make them more prone to reflux. But a lot of the times it's things that we are doing to ourselves. So first things first with reflux. You know, there's things that we can, before we even have to start you in a medicine, there's things that you can do and change in your diet and your lifestyle before we have to add medicines. So one thing I will say about adults with reflux is, you know, we typically we think about it as that burn in, that heartburn pain that you get in the middle of your chest. But it can be more than just that. And especially in our kids. So like, let's say ages like 6 to about 12, where they can't really explain everything that they're trying to tell us. So some things that you may notice in your older kids would be like recurrent nausea or recurrent vomiting. So after they eat big meals, they're more prone to throwing up. And this is for adults as well, too. So you kind of get this like nausea after you eat, or you vomit after you eat. Belching, so lots of burping after you eat can also be a sign of reflux. Bad taste in your mouth. We've definitely seen that. I saw that not too long ago. I had a young teenager talking about she feels like her breath always smells. And so I asked a bunch more questions, and it sounded a little bit concerning for reflux. And we actually started her in some acid suppression. And when I saw her back in the clinic, she was doing much better. So bad taste in your mouth, bad smell in your mouth. Those can all be signs of reflux. So just some things to think about. It may not be just straight up like I have the burning in my chest. There's lots of other things that can go along with that. But again, for our older kids and adults, we don't always have to do any kind of test to diagnose it. A lot of times we'll just tell you some lifestyle changes, or we may give you a medicine to try to see if it would work. And we can pretty much diagnose it just based off of clinical history and a trial of a medicine. You don't have to have a big old gamut of tests to say that you have heartburn or reflux. So we can do that. And a lot of these medicines you can actually get over the counter. And so that's why I wanted to make sure we talked about those, because you could actually kind of do this trial yourself. And then if your symptoms don't get better, then you can go to the doctor and see what's going on. Just so some things that we do that can potentially make it worse. I would say diet is one of the biggest things. So like Lacey mentioned earlier, spicy foods, terrible for reflux. Acidic foods, terrible for reflux. Fatty foods can be bad for reflux as well. So why does that make it worse? So acidic food. So what's causing the pain? I guess we should start with that, is when you reflux those food contents, the acid, you know, a lot of that stuff to break down the food. The gastric contents, the stomach contents, contain a lot of acid to break down our food. And so a lot of that acid gets sent back up into the esophagus. It burns, it irritates, and it causes when it hits the lining of the esophagus and the stomach long enough, then it can really irritate the lining and you can get some inflammation, and that's what causes the pain. You've probably heard the term gastritis before. I don't know if you've heard that term, but that's essentially just inflammation in the lining of the stomach. And so the long-standing acid is what causes that. So if you eat acidic foods, that's going to make the acid worse. So that's going to be like orange juice, tomato sauce, anything like that, that's going to make it worse. That's why all those red foods make it worse. Pizza, pastas, all that stuff makes it worse.
All of my favorites.
I know. Chocolate can be bad. Caffeine can be bad.
You're killing me.
I know. And the reason those are bad is because the little lower esophageal sphincter, so the little muscle at the end of the esophagus that squeezes it off so that it can help keep those stomach, those contents in the stomach, those foods can actually relax that. And so if that's not squeezing tight, it's going to kind of go back up and reflux into your esophagus too. And then fatty foods, you know, fatty foods tend to kind of slow the gastric emptying down. You know, after you eat like a good fried chicken, fried fish, fried French fries, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, if you feel like it just kind of sits on your stomach for a while. And that's because a lot of those fatty foods just kind of slow everything down. The longer it sits in your stomach, the more chance that those contents are going to sit there and irritate the lining of your stomach and all of that. So a lot of it is what we do to ourselves with just what we eat. And then I mentioned earlier, just our lifestyle too. You know, majority of us eat our biggest meal at supper time. You know, and depending on the timing of when you eat supper, most people probably it's not till 6-7 o'clock at night. And then if you go lay down for bed 9 or 10, you know, that's only a couple of hours difference. And so then you go lay down, which just makes it all worse. So a lot of it is timing and the size of our meals that we do. Tobacco, smoking, alcohol, all of that can actually make it worse as well. And then being overweight, there is also a connection to that too. Obesity can tend to make reflux worse as well. So if you can change, you know, some of this, like watching what you take in your diet, maybe losing a little bit of weight, stopping smoking, stopping drinking, all of the things that we know that can make it worse, and you're still having trouble with it, that's when we tend to go and do some medicines. And the first thing is, like the caller I mentioned earlier, just get some antacids. Get some Tums, get some Rolaids, you know, any of those antacids that you get over the counter. We've talked about reflux before, and people have called in and said they make their own concoction with a little bit of baking soda. Just anything that can neutralize that acid and take that away. You should be able to tell a difference within 5 minutes. I also like Maalox too, because Maalox has the acid neutralizer plus the gas medicine, the simethicone. And so if you get a lot of those, sometimes you get those gas pains too with it. You know, you just feel like you have that trapped gas. The Maalox can be really good for that too. So
mint helps, I've found. Like if you chew a piece of minty gum or suck on a peppermint, it'll usually calm things down.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because technically, peppermint sometimes can make it worse, so for certain people, because it can lower that esophageal sphincter that I was talking about, too. So if you eat it consistently, so.
Well, I'm not popping 10 at a time.
Well, that's true. And I guess all those, like, I just remember my dad always, Rolaids were his thing. Tums, but he loves some Rolaids. And those always had that kind of minty flavor to them, too.
Right, they smelled
peppermintish. So. Yeah.
Well, before the break, you said that omeprazole and for a long term can be problematic. Why is that?
Yeah. Okay. So first we recommend antacids. Then the next step would be histamine blockers. So that's going to be like your Pepcid, Zantac, Tagamet. Those work on the histamine receptors that directly secrete the acid. So they work pretty quickly, too. And you can get those over the counter as well. That would be the next line that I would say, if they antacids, then go to the histamine, the Zantac, the Pepcid. And then if those don't work, then we go to the medicines like the omeprazole that you're talking about. That class of medicine is called protein pump inhibitors. So the reason they work so well and they're the best ones for reflux is because they block the pumps that lead to the acid secretion. So, I mean, this is not just like, oh, we're blocking the acid. This is like we're blocking what causes the acid. So we are really eliminating it altogether. So they work really, really well. Those are going to be your medicines like omeprazole, which is Prilosec, Nexium, esomeprazole. There's Protonix or Pantoprazole. You know, there's a whole big class of medicines. There's several of these medicines. But the Nexium, the Pepcid, Prilosec, and then Prevacid, that's another one that you can get over the counter as well. They work great. The problem is they work so well that sometimes it can actually affect the way that you absorb certain things and nutrients. So it can affect the way you absorb calcium, magnesium, some of the other elements that we need for our bone strength. And that's when it becomes a problem. When you're on this long term, it can lead to some of these nutrient deficiencies. The other thing that we worry about is long term, we have seen it affect the kidneys. Now, it doesn't do this often, but there is a certain type of kidney injury that it can cause. And if you were on these for a long time, you're at higher risk for developing those problems with your kidneys. So if you're on these for many, many years, these are the people. Typically, it's not going to be like if you just take it for a couple of months here and there, you're not going to have a lot of these problems. This is more of if you've been on this for a long time, that's when we run into these problems. And I have seen the kidney injury. I have seen people with particularly magnesium problems that we've had a hard time keeping their magnesium up. And we stop their PPI and start them on some replacement, and all of a sudden their magnesium is back to normal. So it can happen if you stay on these medicines for too long. So that is why we say we don't do those. But they are the best medicines for reflux out there. So if you have severe reflux, we are going to tell you to start those medicines. And again, they're over the counter, so they're easy access for you to give yourself a trial of it. But I like to tell people, and what the GI doctors tell people to do if you have like a bad gastritis or esophagitis, is to get on those medicines, but try to limit it to like an 8 to 12 week trial. And the reason you need to stay on those for a long time is because it takes a while for that lining to heal up. So you want to stay on those medicines, take them for, 8 to 12 weeks, let all that acid be suppressed, let your stomach lining, your esophageal lining heal up, and then you can start those medicines again. I mean, stop those medicines and hopefully do some of those lifestyle changes and it'll be okay. Now, you're probably going to have another flare of reflux, and that's okay. You may have to do it again on down the road. But the idea would be not to stay in those medicines long term if you don't have to. Now, the other tricky thing about these medicines is they work so well at suppressing the pumps that when you stop them, if you just stopped them, say you've been taking the over-the-counter omeprazole is 20 milligrams. The prescription one's 40 milligrams. But even so, 20 to 40, that's not that much of a difference, to be honest, if you've been on them long-term. If you've been suppressing those pumps for so long and then all of a sudden you stop them, well, the pumps come back and it's like they come back with a vengeance, secreting that acid. So a lot of people will say, I tried, I stopped it, and my symptoms just got way worse. Well, we know that's a potential to happen just because of the nature of the medicine. So I try to tell people not to just stop it cold turkey because of that, because we know that it's going to make your symptoms worse. So you've taken it for a long time, it sounds like. And if you stop it, I'm sure your symptoms kind of flare up because you have been on it for so long.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, Doc, this weekend is basketball Final Four, and I will be having pizza and wings. But after this weekend, I'll probably chill out just because you told me to.
And the Alabama's playing.
Alabama's playing.
In the Final Four.
So you know I can't give up my acid reflux medicine this week.
No. Plus, between the food and the stress of the Final Four with your team playing
gotta
in it.
Gotta have some pizza.
Yeah.
But so, after this weekend, I will save my kidneys.
Well, that's a good thing. But if you, so what I would tell you to do is I would slowly, taper it off. I don't know if you're taking, are you taking just one of the over-the-counter or do you have a prescription for it?
So my prescription was just omeprazole times 20.
Okay.
And so when I didn't, want to get that filled, I just got the lesser dosage and just started buying that once a week.
Yeah. So if you're on the 40, I would tell you to go get the over-the-counter. Like, that's the prescription one. I would tell you to get the over-the-counter, which is the 20 milligrams. And then, so do that for a couple of weeks and then maybe go to every other day for a couple of weeks and then try to stop it. And you may want to get you some Pepcid just to have it on hand, just if your symptoms get really bad and flare back up, because the likelihood is that they probably will. So
there is a under the tongue nausea medicine that they give to like chemo patients that I was prescribed a couple years ago for nausea and stuff.
Zofran.
Do what?
Zofran.
Oh, will that mess up my kidneys?
No.
Okay.
But it's, no, Zofran should not. However, Zofran is not something you want to use long term.
Right.
Because it is a great nausea medicine, but it has some other side effects too, particularly constipation. It slows everything down and it can get people really backed up.
It can cause headaches too.
Yeah, maybe. I don't have that one as much, but yeah. I mean, any medicine can cause headaches for sure.
Great. That's great.
Yeah.
That's just great.
It's one of those things that, like, if you tell me it caused a headache, I'm like, oh, probably did,
You're like, yeah, that and 10 other things caused your headache.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so many potential medicines out there that cause headaches that doesn't surprise me. And everybody is affected differently by medicine. So nothing surprises me when somebody says a side effect that they have. But typically, that's not a common one with Zofran. But the constipation for sure is, for sure. So before we end, I want to make sure that I mention there are certain conditions that can make reflux worse. And so if you have been on these medicines, so say you go and you get, you've been listening to this and you're like, well, I've tried the Pepcid and it's not getting better. Let me go get some of that omeprazole stuff that she's talking about. And you do your own little trial for, a month or two and you're like, hey, this is not getting any better. Because usually with starting those medicines, within a couple of weeks, you should notice a difference and you're not getting any better. You need to go see somebody, because if you've been on those medicines and your symptoms aren't better, you need somebody to take a look and see what's going on. And when I say take a look, that means they put a camera down your throat, look in your esophagus into your stomach and see what's going on in there. You could have an ulcer in there that's making it worse. You could have, there's a like a hiatal hernia. You've heard that term, where part of the stomach essentially kind of goes up into the esophagus, which makes it really hard to control reflux if you have that hiatal hernia there. If you have a condition, an infection called H. pylori, I don't know if anybody's heard of that out there, but it is a bacteria that you can actually have in your stomach that can cause worsening reflux. So we can treat your reflux all day, but if that bacteria is there, it's going to continue to make the reflux worse. And so if you have that condition called H. pylori, there's a couple of ways we can test for it. The best way to test is just to take an actual biopsy of your stomach. So that's what we do when we put the camera down and we take the biopsy. The other thing we can do is we can do a stool test. We can do a stool antigen test. You have to be on those off those medicines, those proton pump inhibitors, for 2 weeks before we can do that test because it can interfere with it. But you can bring a stool sample up and we can test for H. pylori that way. So those are some of the things. Oh, another one would be eosinophilic esophagitis, which is just a fancy term for kind of like an allergic component to it, I guess. The eosinophils are one of the types of white blood cells that we see a lot with allergic responses. And so some people have extra kind of inflammatory response to that. A lot of those people who have eosinophilic esophagitis can also have swallowing problems too, because the reflux gets so bad that it actually causes swallowing problems as well. So if you're having symptoms despite being on the appropriate therapy, the next step would be to put a camera down because we need to see if something else is going on. Those things that I just listed are all very common reasons for us to have difficulty controlling your reflux. So the only way to truly diagnose a lot of those is just putting a camera down and taking a look. So
do you do those tests on like young babies?
Yes, they don't do those. They're not quick to jump to those as much in babies as they are adults. But it's the same process. If eosinophilic esophagitis, H. pylori, that happens in young kids too. So they will do that. But I would say they probably try to reserve that so you get to be a little bit older if they can.
I was about to say, they would have to tranquilize me. That sounds very spooky. Yeah.
Well, it's the same thing as like a colonoscopy. So it's kind of the same process. So they put you to sleep. It's not like a knock you out, push the breathing tube in you and all that stuff. It's more of kind of like that twilight sleep where you're asleep and you don't really know what's happening. And the other nice thing is a lot of the medicines they used to put you to sleep, you can't remember things after it too.
That sounds terrifying.
Well, so you don't remember a lot of things. So, you know, like you've seen all the crazy videos of people waking up from anesthesia and they say all the silly stuff and then they don't remember any of it. So a lot of the medicines that do that and make you sleepy and, you know, funny, you don't remember. That's one of the things about it. So you just don't remember a lot of it. So
that's what I would need.
You know, whoever took you to the scope, and they're going to have a good time watching you wake up, but you won't remember any of it.
Great.
So, well, I hope this has been helpful because reflux is so common out there. So maybe this is something that you were listening to and you've heard some of this and it's going to prompt you to go get your EGD or your camera down your throat and see what's going on in there. Or maybe you could go find some of these medicines and give it a try yourself and see if that can help you. Thanks, Lacey, for your help today as our show producer. And I think Trey was our call screener. This has been Southern Remedy Kids and Teens. It's a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center and generous support from listeners like you. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod. Join us next Thursday at 11 and stay tuned for NPR's Here Now coming up next.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.